Good evening. Thank you for coming again. Those of you who are coming a second time, I'm very impressed. So we're in the second session of our Transforming Problems module. So why don't we, before we start, we'll just do a short meditation to kind of settle our minds and bring ourselves back or bring ourselves to the present. So usually the meditation that, you know, I'm not leading it really because I'm, anybody here who hasn't ever meditated or doesn't know how to sit? I mean, knows how to sit, but really doesn't know how to sit. Okay, good. So I'm not really leading it, but just basically you can use the breath of the object. You know, if you come to Geshe Lo's teachings on Sunday mornings, you know, he does 21 breaths. That's one. You can, if you have your own breathing meditation, you can do that. Or if you have an object that is an image, you can do that too. Whatever works for you. I personally use the image because breathing meditation for me is very difficult for whatever reason. So I have a hard time with a breathing meditation. Anyway, so let's just do that for a few minutes. And we'll probably end, towards the end, we'll do a short meditation on impermanence.
So if we think about how everything is a constant state of flux, our bodies are changing continuously, new cells are forming, old cells are dying. The mind that I had a second ago is not the same mind that I have now because of thoughts that have and experiences that have changed me. And all our worldly or things in the world that we hold on to are all in a state of impermanence. So there's this verse that goes, that summarizes it all, that says, collection ends in dispersal. So everything that we accumulate, collect, all our material wealth, possessions, everything that we hold dear, collection ends in dispersal. So we can't take it with us. Somebody may take it away from us. The bank may take it from us. Rising ends in falling. So we, all those people, politicians who have risen in stature, and somehow one day they get defeated, have to resign due to scandals. People one day who are promoted get fired the next. Meeting ends in parting. So we can think about all the friends we made in elementary school and middle school and high school and college. Somehow they fell by the wayside. But they were our best friends at the time. Other people we hold very dear or held very dear, our girlfriends or boyfriends or spouses. Things happen and we don't recognize them anymore if we pass them on the street, let's say. Friends become enemies. And then finally, birth ends in death. So at the end of it, we still have that day of reckoning. So like that, everything that we hold dear, everything that we strive for in this world with our eight worldly concerns are finally of very little use. So we need to think about what is of use and how we can how we can strive towards those goals. You know, Buddhists can be really depressing. Constant talk about suffering, death. We need a party director. Anyway, yes. Oh, questions. Yes, and in fact, we didn't have time for questions last week, so if you have questions this week.
So, well, we're on the subject of, you know, it being depressing because we're talking about suffering. Sometimes, you know, when I think, you know, the amount of rebirths it takes to develop the karma, especially I was watching a biography of the Buddha, and he kind of had the karma to be able to sit in meditative equipoise for hours and hours, and for me it's like a big deal if I can get 10 seconds, so that means if I'm lucky, I can come back. Come back as a human. Excuse me. That is kind of depressing. I mean, how much effort really is needed to come back as a human and, you know, in a, I guess, a rebirth that's conducive to Dharma practice? I mean, do you have to join the Sangha? Is that a requirement? Or?
Okay. So, well, the good news is, if you think about it, we are here in a human rebirth, and we have the conducive environment, right? So it is very rare. That is true, right? That's what they say. It is very rare, and the scriptures will tell you how rare it really is. But I think the reason they talk about it so much is because they really want to make us understand how truly important it is that we don't waste time now, right? And so I think what the lamas say is that we should try to do our very best. You know, each of us are certain, you know, or maybe some are farther along in their spiritual path than others are, you know, So, but wherever we are, we have to do our very best so that we continue to accumulate merit and wisdom in this life, right? The life that we have now. And so that sets up the causes and conditions for a human life the next time around, right? So the causes for a human life, rebirth, are virtuous actions. That's basically it's general, you know, they say, for example, the cause for wealth, if you are materially, you know, sufficient or whatever, you know, not necessarily wealthy, but you have all the material, your material needs are satisfied, let's say, right, or taken care of, then that's a result of having practiced generosity in our previous lives, right? So that's a direct causal relationship. Human rebirth, there is not a, my understanding is that it's basically if you do virtuous deeds and you refrain from non-virtuous actions, then you create the causes for a human life. Okay? Which kind of makes sense because if you think about it, when you create if you do non-virtuous actions, you're basically going to be born in the lower realms anyway. Right? But also, then they also say, like Geshe-la said a few weeks ago, that it's kind of hard to actually be born in the lower realms. You actually have to do some things that are really bad, you know. So, like, you have to kill, and you have to do something. You know, you have to be quite bad to be born in the lower realms, like in the hell realms and all that stuff that they talk about. But Lama Zopa Rinpoche, when he comes, he'll probably dispute that. He'll probably say that, you know. So he's much stricter. So I don't know. But bottom line is that if we use our human potential this life as best as we can, if we make our best effort, right? And then we set ourselves up for good rebirths the next time, right? So what that means is we do as much, you know, going around the stupa and so forth and so on, collect as much merit as we can through virtuous actions, through virtuous thoughts, so forth and so on, right? We try to purify as much of the negative merit that we have accumulated in our countless previous lifetimes through confession practices, through cherishing others, which is actually one of the best ways of accumulating merit and purifying negative karma is by practicing the six perfections, you know, cherishing others, compassion, patience, generosity, all those things, right? So, no, you don't have to join this. You don't have to become a monk to make progress, right? Some people actually they become monks or nuns and they have an incredibly hard time. It's not easy. Once it's actually, in some cases, it's actually harder. You know, so I've had someone tell me, for example, they've been a monk for 30 years and he said the first 20 years were hell. Okay. Then they finally kind of figured it out and after that it was a lot better. So, but he persevered. A lot of people, you know, stop. You know, I mean, one of the reasons I was telling this story, was I telling this last Monday or was it yesterday? I don't know. I was subbing for Geshe-la yesterday, so I can't remember where I told the story. But you know, I was talking about Venerable Rene taking a trip, and he was saying that there are very few elder monks left, right? He's in his mid to late 50s, and they're among the group of people who became monks, men who became monks. He wasn't talking about nuns specifically, but just monks. There's only maybe four or five who are older than him who are still monks. You know, most of them actually just disrobed. I mean, there were many, many monks who disrobed. And they're still students of Lama Zopas, and they're still... I don't know why am I going into all this. Anyway, but what I'm trying to say is, you know, I mean, they disrobed, but they all have jobs in the FPMT and et cetera. So they're still connected to Buddhism. It's just that it was very... So becoming a monk to make more progress is not necessarily a done deal either, you know? So that's all I'm trying to say. So the best thing to do is, what Lama Zopa says, is to always spend every day, every moment of every day in the best possible way to be of maximum benefit, of always doing something, thinking about something virtuous, always doing something virtuous. And if we do that, everything else just falls into place. That's what he says. You know? And the answer of how long does it take? Well, if it didn't take a long time, we would have been Buddhas by now, you know? So it takes, in the sutra path, they say it takes quite a few eons. In the sutra path, it takes quite a few eons, they say. But, you know, some of us, as I said, some of you in this room may be quite great accomplished practitioners, in which case, if you don't make it in this lifetime, there's ways of making it in within three, and if not, within seven, they say. So, you know, it's not that hard either, based on if you have done all the work in the previous lives, right? That's the thing. If you've done the work for eons in the before, then you might be able to make it in this lifetime or three from now or seven from now. Anyway, I don't know if it helps you be less depressed. Yes, if you use the microphone. Yes.
So you're saying we could have done something in the past to help ourselves along the path.
Yes, we have, because otherwise we wouldn't be here.
Here otherwise, right.
Yes.
Because sometimes in the story they'll say, and so-and-so was enlightened. And you know, he was sweeping the floor and suddenly he realized this is blah, blah, and he was enlightened. So I'm assuming, am I correct, that this individual did something in a prior life, even though they don't remember it.
Oh, absolutely. Even the Buddha, for example, they said he didn't become enlightened just like that.
Mm-hmm.
He did. He had set himself up. He had done countless lives of practice, and
because
you know that's why they have the Jataka tales of his previous rebirths.
Right. Right. Because there's so many teachings, and I'm thinking, do we need to know all those?
Well, I mean, as you go along the path, in some form or fashion, you will, even if you don't read it. I mean, you experience them, right? So you don't have to read them to know the teachings. You experience them yourself.
Okay, thank you.
Right, so. Any questions from... Oh, so I'll just recap from what we did last week, so in case in case you have come up with questions. So basically we talked about, we started on transforming problems and why cherishing others is the best way of transforming problems, right? Whatever problems that we have. And because all our problems is due to the suffering that we have today is because of the karma that we've created in the past, right? We create karma because of our pursuit of the eight worldly concerns, right? You know, for those of you who weren't here last week, you know, the eight worldly concerns are, you know, gain and loss, right? Material wealth, wanting material wealth and not wanting loss, pain. I mean, discomfort and comfort and hardship, right? Then there's fame, good reputation and not a good reputation, wanting a good reputation or doing things to have a good reputation versus not. And then praise and blame, right? We want praise and we don't want blame. So those are the eight worldly concerns. And so we create karma based on our... You know, all our activities being motivated by the eight worldly concerns, and we engage in eight worldly concerns because of our basic attachment and aversion to ourselves, right? So the attachment for things, we exaggerate the qualities of things we like, and that's considered attachment. We denigrate the qualities, or I guess we exaggerate the bad qualities of things we don't like, right? So that becomes aversion, right? So the eight worldly concerns are based on underneath it is attachment aversion. And underneath attachment aversion, you have the basis, I mean, the reason for that is because of our self-grasping, right? We exaggerate our sense of self, me and mine, so forth and so on. And the accompanied self-cherishing, right, where we hold ourselves and our needs higher or more important than those of others, right? And the root cause of all, root of that, which is the root of everything, all of our suffering, is the basic ignorance, which is the not being, believing in a deluded view of ourselves and others and phenomena in general, and truly believing it to be true, right? So that's the ignorance part of it, right? So all our problems are based on that. So the question, and we were going through the eight verses, right? Lama Zopa's translation of the eight verses, and what he said was that cherishing others is like he calls it the rocket missile, rocket-powered missile, that kind of attacks the cherishing, self-cherishing mind, right? The self-grasping and the self-cherishing. So if we cherish others, it works as an antidote. And if you meditate and analyze and come to an understanding that self-cherishing is the root, is the cause, the basis of all of our problems, then if we cherish others and that is the antidote, then that's the right thing to do, right? And if you believe that, then the eight verses is basically what it says. If we follow the eight verses, then our problems become less, our mind becomes, you know, the benefits they said, right? The mind becomes calm, Actually, I said this yesterday, but maybe I didn't say this the first day, last Monday. But one of the benefits of cherishing others, our mind becomes calm and peaceful. Our environment becomes peaceful. Our interactions with others become peaceful. They react peacefully with us. All those things come out of cherishing others. It's not immediate. It's interesting. There's a wonderful book called Dear Lama Zopa. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's in the bookstore, and I'm sure it's there in the library too. There's three copies I just saw. And it's basically letters that his students and others have written to Lama Zopa over the many decades about their problems and what his answer was to each of them, And if you write if you have problems, I do, when I have some things, I send a letter to Lama Zopa, and he actually reads them and replies, it's interesting. He replies to every single one of them. So, anyway, so it's very interesting to read that book, and it's amazing how many people with just incredible difficulty, people with AIDS back when there was no cure for AIDS. Or I guess there's not a cure now either, but at least you can live, right? You can manage it, but back then you with a death sentence. People with just great physical and mental, problems, and so forth and so on. So anyway, it's interesting to see what his answer is. And almost most of them, the answer is, treat others with compassion, think about cherishing others. All of those are, it's kind of feels like it's the same. He's giving you the same answer, right? I mean, really. You kind of wonder, I've sent him letters myself, and he comes back and he says, do this practice and do more cherishing others, And you're kind of like, okay, how is that going to help me, But because we think small, right? We think, if we can't solve this one problem, how is this going to help me with this one tiny problem, right? But what do you say? And it may not be tiny to us, right? To us, it's a big deal, right? But what he's trying to say is that cherishing others is such an amazing practice, right? It attacks every problem, right? It's not just one problem. It's not just, my wife left me. How do I deal with that? Cherish others. So how is that going to solve my problem? But, it's interesting because it actually helps all of our, it's all in the mind, right? At the end of the day, it's all in our minds. It's our perception. Right? So if our mind and attitude can change, it changes everything, right? And that's what he's trying to get at. So, it's the last time. So that's why there's so much, among those teachings. There's a huge body of teachings. And you'll see, if you go to the bookstore, you'll see this big, gigantic book called Mind Training. It's a collection of all the it's a body of teachings called Mind Training, which is basically about compassion, generating compassion, cherishing others, etc. And it's this gigantic book of all these teachings from the Buddhist canon, the Tibetan canon, that's been collected out, in this big book. And so there's a lot of, and so that's why they hold this in such great regard, this practice. So it's a really profound practice, and that's why Rinpoche, not just Rinpoche, Chodron Rinpoche, all the great Tibetan lamas, His Holiness Dalai Lama, everybody just continuously, especially for Westerners, continuously, emphasizes it. So anyway, so the first verse that we did last week was, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I shall hold them most dear at all times. So that was the verse that we did last week. So anyway, so before I go on to the, before we go on to the next verse, do you guys have any questions? I'm just trying to, I just kind of went through the introduction just to kind of remind you what we did so that if you were a question, you would remember it. And apologize for not doing it last week.
Are you going to put it online?
Oh, yes, I'm finding out if I can, when I can, because Sarah has to get the copyright. You know, that's the only reason I can't put it online right now is because we have to check the copyright. So, okay. So we'll continue with the other verses. And, you know, actually the eight verses are also in your, you know, in the Discovering Buddhism reading material, you know, except that it's slightly different translation, but it's basically the same. And the first one, you know, the eight verses of thought transformation by His Holiness Dalai Lama. So that's basically the same verses. It's just that I'm just using Lama Zopa's translation rather than His Holiness. Partly because we're in Lama Zopa's tradition, so it's kind of... Okay. So the next verse says, when in the company of others, I shall always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear, most dear and supreme. So that's, you know, that's always a, you know, when you first read it, you know, when in the company of others, I shall always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart hold others dear and supreme. The lowest of all part always trips people up, trips me up too, you know, because, you know, in the West we have, and I'm considered myself a Westerner because I lived in India until I was 15, so I, you know, most of my life has been here. So in the West, you know, we have this thing about, you know, we stress individualism, independence, pride, you know, all those things greatly, right? So when we say, when it says lowest of all, oh my God, does that mean that, you know, anyway, I'll get into that in a minute, but basically what it's trying to get to is the whole attitude of pride that we have. And when they say pride, it's this arrogant pride that they're talking about. Right? So most of our actions are based on a sort of arrogant pride. Right? So pride in, you know, in Buddhist psychology there's 51 states of mind. You know, when you perceive something, there's 51 things that can arise. And pride is one of them. You know, there's other positive things, ones that arise, and negative ones that arise. Pride is one of the negative ones, you know. And what they're talking about is this arrogant pride, which exaggerates our self-importance. Right? So yesterday I gave an example, for instance, when I was, many years ago, 20 years ago, I was living in California, and I bought this car, a fancy German car, because I deserved it, I felt. You know, I was financially well off. And I thought I deserved it. And, you know, it was interesting after I bought it, the sense of pride that came with it. It was a sense of arrogant pride, you know. It was very interesting. I really noticed it. I mean, I would drive down and I would feel superior. You know, I would notice other people's car and how they were not a German car. You know, it's very interesting how that works. So like that, you know, it was kind of I never thought of myself as a proud person, you know, at least an arrogant proud person, but I definitely was. And so it kind of opened my eyes to it, you know. And so it's that self-importance, exaggerated self-importance that they're talking about. And it doesn't mean, you know, and there's a part of it that is kind of has a, you know, it tends to denigrate others, right? So it's at the cost of others. And that's where the real problem lies. I mean, they're not saying that we shouldn't appreciate ourselves. In fact, the opposite, right? When Geshe La teaches, when Lama Zopa teaches, when His Holiness teaches. I mean, the thing that they always say is how incredible, fortunate we are. We have this life. How it's important to do the best, and we must strive to meet, you know, reach our potential, whether it's at work or whether in our family, whether in spiritually, whatever it is, right? It's very important. So we have to. There is an amount of a self appreciation part that they're talking about, right? But when they say pride, they're talking about this. You know, I want to earn more money, or I want to gain that promotion because I want to show. You know, I want to show off, right? You know, there's nothing wrong with wanting that promotion because we. You know, there are different ways. You know, I mean, one can want a promotion because, well, if I have that promotion, then I can do this much more benefit, right? There's one way of thinking about it, right? But most of the time, we don't think about it like that, right? We think about the promotion because it's going to bring us more money. Unfortunately, I found that when I get a promotion, the more money comes, and somehow or other, I don't seem to have any more in my bank account. I don't know exactly how that works. But in any case, you know, so we, you know, we think we're going to make more money. People are going to think higher of us, better of us, so forth and so on, right? So that's where, that arrogant pride comes in. And it also kind of feeds, you know, the pride also is, it can also be the fuel of further negative actions. You know, like Rinpoche is an example of, I don't know if this was something that was related to him by a student or not. But anyway, he has this example of how, you know, you can, well, actually, I'll give you the example later. But in any case, so, the other thing I want to stress is that when they say lowest of all, the lowest does not mean self, you know, lower self-esteem or, you know, despise, you know, I don't know, you know, making oneself inferior. That's not what they're talking about, right? Which, you know, because, you know, the self-blame, the martyrdom, all that stuff that comes with a sense of inferiority, right? Because that's actually, you know, that's actually another form of attachment, right? Because it's about myself. Oh, I'm so terrible, right? I mean, that's how the Buddhists say, right? When you are engaging in martyrdom or victimhood or, you know, low self-esteem or whatever, it's actually another form of attachment because it's, again, all about us, right? I'm so terrible. You know, people are always doing this to me, you know, so forth and so on, right? So when they say, I will hold myself lowest of all, they're not saying like that. What they're saying is that I'm going to appreciate every, you know, I'm going to think of myself last. I'm going to think of others, how wonderful they are, how wonderful that so-and-so at work got a promotion, right? I rejoice in his good fortune, right? Like that. I don't need to think badly of myself. I don't need to make myself lower than them, right? I can think of them as, you know, how one, you know, think of them with, you know, I wrote this down. I was reading some other book, and it said, really value others' good fortune and value others with true goodwill, right? So we don't have to make ourselves lower. It's just that we have to consider others as just wonderful, right? And sometimes it's difficult because there may be others that we don't really like. And that's where the real work happens. It's easy to rejoice for people that we really like. You know, I mean, that's easy, right? But it's when when we have annoying people who we work with or who we have to deal with in our families and so forth and so on, and set the annoyance aside and try to just feel happy for them. That's, if we can do that, that's really marvelous. And I think that's what they're talking about. And the other thing also is that, you know, we also tend to think that, you know, we're really proud of ourselves for some result that happened, right? Let's say we get a promotion. I'm just using this as an example, right? We get a promotion because we did such a great job, right? But the interesting thing is that the Buddha's view is that the good fortune that happens to us, or bad luck, whatever you want to call it, whichever way it is, right? The good fortune that happens to us is not immediate like that, right? In other words, I write a great report today and tomorrow I get a promotion. There's no causal relationship. I mean, there is a causal relationship in the sense that, you know, if I didn't write a good report, they're not going to consider me for a promotion anyway, right? I mean, if I'm a slob, they're not going to give me a promotion anyway, right? So I have to create the causes to get a promotion. But the good fortune that happens actually has been set up already previously in our previous lives. So that's karma that's ripening. And our writing a good report just happens to create the causes for that ripening to happen, right? The seed was already there. We, you know, the report basically, you know, was fertilizer on the ground for the seed to sprout, right? Like that. So we tend to become very proud of our actions in this life. But we don't realize, they say, that most of our results that happen in this life are actually results of things that happened, the things that we did previously. Right? So we have to have a sense of humility. You know, I think that's what they're talking about. You know? So which kind of brings, you know, if good things happen, we rejoice and we just let go. If bad things happen, well, we try to let go. Right? We do some practices and try to have a mind of equanimity and try to let go and continue on, right? Without having these ups and downs. Because we get that promotion, we have this huge up, right? And then somebody criticizes us and we're like, oh, you know? But if we're able to kind of just have a sense of humility about it, right? Then we kind of are much more even keel. It doesn't mean that we're boring people and we don't enjoy, you know, the good things that come and so forth and so on. But it just means that, you know, we take things much less seriously, you know, much less, you know, Geshe-la says much less uptight. Is that what he always says, uptight? I think he means like not as tightly. I think that's what he means. But we tend to hold things really tightly, you know. And so when things don't go our way, you know, then it just, you know, our minds fall apart, right? I don't know if I made sense or not. Did that make sense, what I was saying about the humility? Yeah, okay. You can just stop me and ask me if I'm not making sense. And the other thing about the pride part, the last thing I was going to say was that, you know, we tend to feel a great amount of pride. I mean, we tend to criticize others, right? We tend to judge others, which is also out of pride, right? Because we wouldn't be doing anything like that, would we? Right? I mean, we're much better. And so we tend to judge others' actions, but we don't consider what faults we might have, right? So that's another angle, you know? So that's why pride is a really, it's the more I've thought about it in my life, you know, the more I've been surprised. I wouldn't have considered myself a proud person, but the more I've thought about it, it's interesting about how much mental effort goes in to just dealing with pride. So Rinpoche was using, the example that he was using was where pride can be a fuel for further negative actions. For example, the example he was using was, let's say you're in the workplace and, you know, you're working with some, you know, you're your boss, right? And how often we tend to think that he or she is just doing a terrible job and we could do a much better job and so forth and so on, right? We criticize them in front of others or, you know, to his or her boss, you know, my boss's boss kind of thing. You know, so that's bad already in general, right? Because it's out of pride, right? Out of negative mind, negative state of mind. And then the boss gets fired, right? And you get put in their place, right? And you're feeling really proud now, right? And so, you know, all these things happen. And so, you know, our original pride and the criticism and the judgment and so forth and so on became a reason for somebody else's suffering, right? And so those kind of things, you know, we have to consider, right? That pride that we had to begin with kind of had further repercussions, right? And those things create more fuel, right? More negative karma, right? So that's what he was trying to say, is that these things, we tend to think they're one-off things, but they actually have this ripple effect, which is much worse, actually, than the original thing, because, you know, who knows, that boss might have gotten fired and then they'd have gone home and kicked the dog, you know, and so forth and so on, you know. So what he was trying to get at with that example was that what's most important, and I think the next verse talks about this, is that, you know, it's really critical that we really examine, we always examine what our state of mind is. Because the effect of the actions we commit is not just the action itself, right? It's not, you know, what does karma mean? It just means that it's a seed that we plant in our mind stream, right? It's a seed based on a certain action, whether it's a mental action, mental thought, or it's physical action, right? Through our body. So, and the positiveness or the negativeness of that action is based on the state of mind at which the action took place, right? So, you know, for a karma, you know, I don't know if you remember the karma module, but karma had those four attributes, right? You know, for a complete karma, you have to have, you know, you have to have the intention, you have to have the action, committed action, you have to have the fruit, you know, you have to rejoice at the outcome of the action, right? And then there's last one, which was, I can't remember now. But anyway, so there's just four things, right, for a karma to be complete. And so the intention is the first thing, right? So in other words, they say, for example, like if you intend to kill somebody, right, and at the last, you know, you were ready to strike and you were had the you know, intention to kill, you were ready to strike, and right before you struck, you thought, oh my God, what am I doing? Right? So even if your hand hit the person and killed that person, the intention wasn't there. Right? So it's not a full act of killing. Right? So intention is really important, right? So another example that they use is, for example, of giving to someone, right? Giving food, giving charity, whatever it is, time. But if we can give either out of a true feeling of generosity, or we can give out of pride, right? Same action, but the karmic seed that's created is totally different, right? So like that, it's really, so the Rinpoche uses an example because he's trying to show how it's important to always be examining what's in our mind at every moment. Because every moment, what we're thinking is creating seeds, right? For future positive, you know, merit, future positive results or negative results, right? And, you know, there's you know, if you remember karma, there's a result similar to the cause, environmental result, all this other stuff, right? So, I mean, you know, for example, if, yeah, so the intention is key. So that's why, you know, pride, humility, all these things are emphasized so much. Okay, so the next verse, and I guess we'll, you know, maybe after this verse, we'll stop, and then we'll talk a little bit about kind of practical advice that Rinpoche gives to people, right, on helping them cope with suffering, cope with problems, and how to live in general. So the next verse, it says, vigilant, the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others, I shall confront and avert it without delay. So this is what, you know, I was just talking about. So the moment of delusion, you know, our mind, we have a basic delusion in our minds because of that ignorance we talked about, right? Our minds, they say, you know, all our actions are, they say, contaminated actions because our minds are contaminated by that delusion, right? So even every action of generosity does have a contaminated aspect of it. Only a Buddha, for example, is truly uncontaminated, right? Because they're beyond, they don't no longer have that ignorance. I guess at certain levels of bodhisattvas are uncontaminated as well. But anyway, but in general, our minds are contaminated. It doesn't mean we're bad, it just means our minds have the delusion. And so, you know, if we are not aware of our delusions, then we continuously create causes for future problems. And so, you know, there are things that we can do to rise above our current challenges, right? Unfortunately, the karma that we created for we created karma many lifetimes ago, and whatever problem we're having today is a result of that karma, right? Unfortunately, there's not much one can do once the seed has ripened, right? That's the problem. You know, once we have already are sick, let's say, you know, we have the flu, right? There's not much one can do because the karma the cause and conditions were ripe, and so they ripened, and it came to fruition. There's not much we can do to change that anymore. What we can do is learn ways of dealing with it in the best way possible. Right? So the flu won't go away, but we can at least have some sense of equanimity or be able to be with it. Right? And the other thing, but the most more importantly, what we can do is at least behave in such a way that we don't get the flu again. Right? I think that's what Rinpoche, and that's what the 8 verses get at, right? And so if we behave in such a way the flu don't get, you know, so we can't do anything about the flu now, but we can do something about it again, right? And that's what we're trying to, to answer your question, we're trying to set ourselves up so that maybe, you know, even if we are not, even if we have a long road ahead of us to become Buddhas, right? We can, if we do these things, we will, you know, we won't have the same problems that we're suffering today, right? And there are certain practices, etc., that help even if you, while you have the flu, there's certainly things that we can do. It just won't make the flu go away. It's just make it easier to live with. You know, that's really it, right? So we were talking about how karma, you know, karma is intention, basically, right? So negative thoughts create negative results, positive thoughts create positive results. And, you know, and karma, if you remember, karma increases, right? You know, there's four things about karma. Karma is definite. You know, karma increases. You know, somebody, you cannot take somebody else's karma, right? And the other one is, you won't have a karma for an action you did not commit, right? So those are the four. Karma is definite, karma increases, and the other two, right? So those are the four. So the interesting thing is that if we have a negative thought and we're not vigilant and we continue to kind of engage in the negative thought, right? It's like that tree, you know, like the seed that grows into a big tree, right? So over time, it becomes this gigantic thing, right? It becomes this really powerful karma, right? I mean, that's why they the 10 non-virtuous act, right? The 10 non-virtuous actions, the 3 of body, the 4 of speech, and 3 of mind, right? And one of the 4 of speech is idle, it's called idle talk or just gossip, right? And the reason it's there is because gossip is there because it's not by itself very much, you know. I mean, you know, idle talk, it's not a very big deal. But we engage in it so much, right? It's the quantity, not the quality there, right? We engage in it so much that it actually grows into really powerful karma over time, right? If we don't purify it, right? Actually, we'll talk about what we can do, but I mean, purification is one of them, right? To cut off karma before it can grow, right? But so that's why, you know, the intention to have a positive intention is so important. So that's why it says vigilant the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others, I shall confront it and avert it without delay, right? There's a story of Atisha, you know, the great Indian master who brought, or I guess he reintroduced Buddhism to Tibet in the 10th century. And so there is a story about how, you know, he would, on his travels, the minute something happened, a minute negative thoughts came up in his mind, or a minute like, you know, I don't know, you know, like that, right? He would stop in his tracks, and he'd been a mountain pass. He'd stop in his tracks, and he'd start doing his Vajrasattvas and his confession practice and all this other stuff, just to make sure that, you know, like this vigilance, right? He's, you know, he confronts it and averts it without delay, right? So we kind of have to be like that. I mean, I'm not saying that we have to stop in the middle of the road and, you know, do our Vajrasattvas, but what I'm saying is we have to be aware, right? I mean, we're not even aware. That's the first problem that we have, but that's solvable, right? I mean, if we meditate and we have a strong practice and a regular practice, that comes automatically. You know, vigilance comes. So once we have that, then we have to, confront it and avert it without delay. Because the longer we wait, the stronger it gets, and the more we will suffer, right? So we have to examine our motivation at all times. And if we don't counter attach, you know, all of this is based on attachment, right? On an aversion, which is the other side of it. So if we don't counter attachment, it spins a story and makes it stronger, right? Which leads to anger, to jealousy, you know, to all the things that we are just all too familiar with. And, you know, an interesting thing is attachment is not, you know, in our world, in our society, it's not considered, you know, it's like we don't even consider it to be a negative mind. You know, we're trained to think that attachment is good. right? I mean, you know, I don't mean quite that. We're Right. We're not even trained to think that there is such a thing, right? Or that, you know. So what's, you know, I mean, you know, what's wrong with getting another pair of jeans when my closet is already full of pairs of jeans, right? I'll just go shopping, right, for another pair of jeans or shoes or whatever it is, right? You pick, right? I mean, or you know, I find it interesting. You know, I don't know anybody, but I know of people, or I know friends of friends, I guess, friends of friends, who go out shopping to kind of like, what is it called? It's called shopping. Retail therapy, yes, retail therapy. And I first of all, just the term kind of just threw me. But when I heard about it, it was kind of a strange, for me, I thought it was a strange concept, you know? I mean, I have my faults, many faults. Retail therapy hasn't been one of them, you know? I talked about pride, I've had problems with patients, and so for many, I've had many other problems, but retail therapy hasn't been one of them. But I thought it was really interesting that you go shopping just because if you're not feeling well, emotionally, let's say, and you go shopping, right? And, you know, that's attachment, you know, just grabbing onto us, right? You know, we just, so it's, you know, and I don't know, where would our economy be without retail therapy, right? Half the malls would disappear. So, like that, right? So we're not even trained to think of it like attachment, right? It's in a way, in some ways, it's kind of, it's okay, not only okay, it's good, right? So it's definitely swimming upstream for us to think of it like that, you know, to examine every action and especially the intention behind the action. And, you know, the delusions, it says, endanger, you know, it says, it doesn't say vigilant moment of delusion appears in my mind, I shall confront and avert it without delay. It says, delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others. I mean, that's the property of attribute of delusions, right? It endangers ourselves and others. You know, Geshe-la, once in a while, he will say, you know, when we get angry, the person it hurts the most is not the person it's directed at. It's actually the person who is angry himself, right? And we tend to think that, you know, that's another interesting thing. You know, when we get angry, we get things done. You know, like we can get things done if we're angry. You know, like we make people do, you know, if we show enough anger, you know, we can get the guy at the cash register to do what we want, or you know, the customer service person, or whatever, you know, or the guy, you know, our coworker, or whatever it is, right? And so we're also trained to believe that anger, let out your anger, vent your anger, etc., is good, right? Buddhists will say that anger almost invariably is never good. You know, His Holiness Dalai Lama says that what you want to do is look behind the anger, right? Look at what the real issue is. Then act on it. Think about what the right thing to do is and then act on it. But the problem with anger is that at short term it may bring a benefit, right? What we may consider a benefit. But long term it breeds retaliation, resentment, and so forth and so on. Right? So it may bring a short term benefit to us, but long term it usually brings other problems. And that's why he says that, you know, if you have, you know, he's not saying that you shouldn't feel hurt, or you shouldn't feel, if we are mistreated, we shouldn't try to rectify the situation. He's just saying, don't do it out of a sense of anger, right? Examine what you're feeling, and then figure out what the right way to approach it is, right? But if we react out of anger, because it's in Buddhist talk, you know, because it's a negative, it's out of a negative mind, right? The results are going to be negative. If not in the short term, definitely in the long term. And so anger, as one of the 51 mental factors, is actually considered definitely a negative. There's no positive, I don't think it's ever considered a positive emotion or positive mental factor. And, you know, and so similarly with attachment, you know, it's like that too. You know, there's attachment, you know, we're attached to our spouses, we're attached, you know, actually, yeah, so we're attached to our spouses, we're attached to, you know, our family, whoever, right? But one of the things that, I don't know, those of you who were here for, I was here for a few sessions of Venerable Robina's teachings last time she was here, and she spoke about, this stuck with me, this example, right? She said that, you know, if you examine our love, you know, they say that in Buddhism, they say the only love that's truly selfless, right, is a mother's love for her child. That's the only love that's truly selfless. You know, a mother will do anything to protect the child, right? But any other kind of love is actually based on reciprocation, right? So Venerable Urbina was talking about how, you know, a love between a spouses or, you know, girlfriends, etc., is kind of like, you know, I will love you as long as you continue to love me back. Right, because otherwise, you know, marriages fall apart because one person stops loving the other, right? I will, you know, because once you stop loving me and maybe feel love for somebody else, I'm going to stop loving you, right? So there's the reciprocation, right? So that's the, you know, reciprocity that she was talking about. And when there's reciprocity, that is not selfless love. Right, a mother will do anything for the child, regardless of whether the child is thinking about love or not. Right, and so the other types of love is based on attachment, right? Because reciprocity means that there's a self involved, right? You have to, I'll take care of you if you take care of me, right? And I'm sure there are. I mean, this is general. We're talking a generality here, right? I'm sure there are spousal relationships or whatever where there is selfless love involved. And I think there are, you know, there are stories of that. I know of some. So it's not always the case. I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying that in general, that is how it works in our world. So when she talked about it, I said, yeah, you know, I hadn't quite thought about it like that. So anyway, so that's why it's so important to be vigilant, because our delusions endanger not just ourselves but also others. You know, like the anger, for example, right? We get something back. Right, we may get what we want, but then it has ripple effects, right? And it has other repercussions that we may not even be aware of, and it endangers others, right? So, So one of the things I was going to say, I don't know, any questions on the two verses, vigilance and... Okay. So I was going to spend a little bit of time, and I'll do it other times too, of what Rinpoche. By the way, there's this book, which is a wonderful book by Rinpoche called Transforming Problems into Happiness. And I think this is one of the recommended readings. And it's inexpensive, and I think you can get it used anyway. So, and it talks about, you know, what to do when you're you know, how to, some of the things that we've talked about, you know, experiencing problems, using problems to purify negative karma, benefits of rejoicing, so forth and so on. And then there's another one, which is, I think it's available for free, yeah, from the Lamayashi Wisdom Archive, called Making Life Meaningful. And this actually is a fabulous book. And the reason it's a fabulous book, not just a good book, but a fabulous book, is that it really talks about how one can integrate the teachings into one's daily lives, right? So how to have the cherishing attitude when you're washing your dishes, when you're eating your food, when you're driving your car, when you're, you know, and all that stuff, you know? And so it's, because, you know, it's ultimately what we're trying to do is change the way we think, right? Because if we change the way we think, if we change our attitude, our actions will change automatically, right? And people will see, you know, people can tell if our what our attitude is, right? And when they see our attitude, they also change the way they interact with us. I mean, that's the beauty of it, right? That's why charity begins at home, you know, or whatever. Mind training begins at home, you know, because we don't have to change, you know, it's true. We don't have to change other people. But, well, first of all, we can't change other people. That's the first law, right? We can't change other people because, well, first of all, they have to want to change. Secondly, they have to want to do it our way. And thirdly, they have to have the karma to be able to change, right? I mean, there's a lot of things involved, right? So we can't change them. But what we can do is change ourselves. And if we change ourselves, then people around us automatically, if they don't change themselves, they change the way they behave around us, right? So our lives become more peaceful, you know? They don't, you know, we have to deal with fewer problems. I mean, fewer problems arise. I mean, that's what I'm trying, you know. So anyway, so what Rinpoche suggests I go over this as part of the other module. So one of the other modules I do for DB is called Establishing a Daily Practice. And so it's some of the same advice that he gives. I repeat the same advice there. But what Rinpoche instructs all his students is how to set up one's day, right? Because to make cherishing others a continual part of our lives, right? So the first thing we do when we get out of bed, for example, even before we get out of bed, like we're lying in bed, we just open our eyes. So we think, how wonderful that I have another day. Because it wasn't guaranteed. It isn't guaranteed that I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning, right? There was no guarantee that I would wake up this morning, right? I did this calculation, by the way. It turns out that there are 5 people dying every second in this world. So during those 8 hours that I was asleep, you can come up with the multiply and figure out how many people died, you know, out of the 6 billion, right? So chances are not bad that I might not be one of those, right? So he says you wake up and you say, wow, how wonderful that I have another day. And then the next thing you think is, you know, may I be able to spend this day in the best way possible? Right? I don't know what's going to happen today. I don't know what's going to come up, what problem's going to come up today. But at least may I have the motivation that I can spend this day being of most benefit to whoever I come into contact with. right? Whether they mean well towards us or not, right? So that's the first thing. So we kind of set the motivation, right? We set the intention for the day. And it actually has a powerful effect, believe it or not. You know, because even if we're not aware of it, deep down, it is there. And every so often, once in a while, during the day, after a while, you know, during the day, I kind of remember it, you know, because, you know, it's there. I mean, we may not be cognizant of it, but it's there in our subconscious. So, and, you know, over time, as we continue to do this more and more, you know, it becomes second nature. So we really do think about benefiting others, you know? So I'll give an example, you know, like a few weeks ago there was I'm a relatively senior engineer in our company and there's a bunch of people I mentor, you know, kind of like that. And so, you know, I have my own work, right, which takes up most of my day. And then there's all these people call me, right, for help and so forth and so on. And, you know, and it's kind of annoyance a lot of times because I have my own work, I have to meet deadlines, and there are all these people calling me, right? So this guy is calling me at 5:30 in the evening, and I'm like, oh, do I really want to pick this up, you know? If I just ignore it, you know, then he can call me tomorrow, right? But then, you know, I thought, well, you know, I'm supposed to benefit others, you know? So I really should kind of pick it up, you know? And I was glad I did, you know? It wasn't actually, you know, but that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. It's not rocket, you know, we're not talking about me helping some child, you know? I mean, we're not talking some great action, right? But those little things do add up, you know? And they make a difference, right? So like that, you know, if we set the motivation in the morning, it stays with us, and we remember them every so often, you know. And those of you, by the way, who have gone to, like, who've taken refuge, some of you in this room, I think, have taken refuge, and who have gone to, let's say, gotten initiated, like, with Tara practices and so forth and so on. If you remember, there are bodhisattva vows involved, right? So part of the bodhisattva vows is always, no matter what, actually benefiting others, right? If you go through your bodhisattva vows, you go through the long list. So anyway, so you've already signed up for it, is what I'm trying to say. If you've taken those, you know, refuge vows, etc., there's probably in there already. Anyway, actually, maybe not with refuge vows, but if you have taken, like, you know, like the highest yoga tantra, certainly, but if you've taken other, like, you know, lower form of tantra, like Tara, etc., then you've certainly have bodhisattva vows. Okay, so then he talks about in the morning to set up the motivation, you know, how wonderful I have a new day and may I be of benefit. And during the day, we continuously try to practice that, right? And so, for example, when we're, you know, Rinpoche, you know, if you read his books or read his this book, for example, I think he talks about it in here, I'm not sure. But, you know, when you're washing dishes, you can think, you know, washing my dishes, you know, I'm washing off all the delusions of the beings around me, right? May their delusions be washed off, their mind streams, right? Or if you're, you know, there's all kinds of things, like if you open doors, if you're opening a door to walk into a room, may all beings, and, you know, enter the path of Buddhahood, you know, like that, right? And so there's every action that we do, we can think like that, right? And it creates this constant, you know, that's the mind training, right? And so then when that really a time comes when we can be of benefit, we're not shirking from it, right? You know, how often does it is that, you know, we can be of benefit, but we just stand aside, right? We'll just pretend we didn't see it. We'll let somebody else take care of it, right? Happens often to me, right? So like this. But then when we can be a benefit, we actually will be a, you know, so like that. You know, we create this constant mind of benefit, right? So that's the, you know, that's how we can cherish others, create the mind of cherishing others. And of course, I'm not, you know, and then of course he suggests having a practice in the morning, so I'm not going over that. But, and then in the evening, to close out the day, right? So all these practices of thinking about washing dishes, all this other stuff, you know, we're accumulating merit, right? Which is like the, you know, it's like the fertilizer for the seeds to sprout, right? The seeds are our positive karmic potential we've created. The cherishing others, et cetera, creates the cause and conditions, and then the seeds will sprout into positive fruit, you know, results and spiritual growth and human births and so forth and so on, right? So there's accumulation of merit. On the other side, there's purification of negative merit that we've created in the past, right? So things that have not ripened yet, we can try to remove them, right? To cut them off at the root. So what Rinpoche suggests at the end of the day, because we, end of the day, to do a, you know, Vajrasattva purification practice, or also known as a confession practice. You don't have to go confess to anyone, we just confess to ourselves. But we make a confession practice where we think through our day. And because we're human beings, we will have made lots of mistakes. And we just kind of think through our day, and without judgment, we just say, well, you know, I didn't do a very good job there. I didn't treat that person all that well. I could have been, I was kind of rude there, or whatever. Or ignored that person who called me on the phone. And we just say, you know, we have a sense of regret. There's a four, you know, you can read more about the confession practice, or when you come to the other module about establishing a daily practice, we'll talk more about it. But we have this confession practice so that we, whatever negative karma we've created with our thoughts and with our actions during the day, we can set it aside, right? We can, it can't ripen, right? Because that's the whole point of purification. And so we remove future negative results, right? And the other nice thing about it, I've found, is that it removes guilt. You know, if over time, if you really have faith in the practice, and if you have seen its benefit, you know, you realize that you kind of have this attitude of, yes, I was an idiot, but, you know, I'm also a human being and I made a mistake, so I'll make sure that I don't do that again, right? But there's not this feeling of, oh my God, how could I possibly have done that? I'm such a terrible person, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The continuous cycle that we tend to, tend to go around in, right? So it helps us let go. And that's a really powerful thing about the confession practice. And if you want to do the confession practice and you're not familiar with it, if you ask Geshe-la, for example, he would be more than happy to. You know, if a bunch of you ask him, then he would be more than happy to have a, you know, do it. He used to do the Vajrasattva once a week, right? We used to do that a few years ago. He used to rotate it, right? So it was once a month or so it became. But anyway, so it's a really powerful practice, and it really helps letting go of things that we've done. And we can purify not just our days, whatever we've done today. We can purify from many, many countless lives, you know. I mean, that's the whole point, is that we don't want that stuff to ripen in the future, right, to create more problems. I had a, let's see, I have 2 minutes. Let me see if I can find it. I saw this, I took this down. It was a wonderful from many maybe I don't have it here. Okay. Anyway, but basically it was a wonderful prayer from, I don't know, 1,000 years ago from an Indian master about how to do this daily, you know, washing our hands and so forth and so on. But when Rinpoche used to talk about this, I didn't know their lineage, right? I mean, I didn't know that Rinpoche had this whole list of things you can do. He taught us, right? His students, a whole list of things you can, you know, even when you go to the bathroom, there's something you can think, you know? So, I mean, there's a whole list of every action that you commit, everything that you do during the day, how you can have a mind of cherishing others. Right. So going down the stairs, up the stairs, opening the door, closing the door, going to the bathroom, washing the dishes, cooking your meal, everything, right? And I remember in the beginning I thought, wow. But then I realized that there's this long lineage. It actually comes from many thousands, you know, I don't know, many thousands, but at least 1,000 years ago, because I came across this text of this Indian pundit, Indian master. At least he wrote it down, so I don't know how many years before that, or he came up with it or not, I don't know, but at least it's been around for a long time. So it's very interesting. Anyway, we didn't get to do the Tonglen meditation today. I was hoping to, but we'll do it next time. And hopefully I'll have this stuff on the website by next week. I hope to. The meditation will be there as well, so you can take it home with you. So let's finish with a dedication. By my merits of this virtue, may I become a Buddha, and all. By my merits of this virtue, may I become a Buddha and lead all beings to an enlightened state. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow, and may that born not decline but increase more and more. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantabhadra and all those with knowledge dedicated extensively, I also dedicate as they did, just as following their perfect example. By these empty merits, may the I that is empty achieve enlightenment that is empty and lead all beings who are empty to enlightenment myself alone. By these virtuous merits, may I bring happiness to everyone and not cause any harm to anyone. Whatever problems or joys I might have become only helpful for others and cause them all to become Buddhas. Thank you very much.